SAS Brothers in Arms, Damian Lewis's new bestseller, is technically the action-packed, riveting story of the hitherto unknown band of mavericks and visionaries who made the SAS. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from his command centre somewhere in the UK. From his, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Damian? You can't hear me. Okay, fine. Let me just try pushing a three buttons there. Indeed. Yeah, I get you. Hello, Damian. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Ah, there we go. Fantastic. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Fabulous to be with you as always.
Yes, indeed. We must stop meeting like this. Right then, SAS, the long... So this is... But for those who know a little bit about military history, this is... Is it the Long Range Reconnaissance Group originally? What was the idea and who came up with this one?
Yeah, so... The forerunners to the SAS in a North African desert were the Long Range Desert Group. So that was a unit put together to basically carry out deep desert reconnaissance operations right at the start of the war in North Africa. And very quickly, you know, they became the masters at desert navigation. And in fact, they were ferrying secret intelligence service agents across the desert as well to their rendezvous and to their mission. So they had a kind of dual purpose. And then in the summer of 41, of course, David Stirling had his idea for the SAS, you know, realizing that there was a massive expanse of desert in North Africa, you know, the size of the Indian subcontinent, more or less, where you could, if you could get in there and navigate it and penetrate to enemy bases, you could get deep behind the lines and actually attack and not just carry out these reconnaissance operations. So that was kind of the genesis of these two units and how we came to the birth of the SAS.
Because when you look at it, that sort of that expanse, the, you know, what they call it, the great sand sea, I believe it was called roughly, was a whole situation. Because if you like, the oil was obviously very important. They were up against a formidable foe in terms of Rommel and the Africa Corps. The Tobruk had fallen. That whole sort of that strip of coastline from Alexandria all the way across, you know, to across the alongside the Mediterranean, seemed to be another front that the Allies or particularly the British were being defeated at. So this idea of going, if you like, down, you know, going to quote Star Trek, where no man had gone before and fight pretty much undetected was a novel one.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this is, you know, we're talking, you know, spring, summer 41. This is, you know, Allied British fortunes at their darkest hour, you could argue. Battle of Britain, we weathered the storm, the Blitz, likewise. But on the ground, we were facing defeat on all fronts. And indeed, likewise in North Africa, as you just pointed out, General Rommel, you know, the Desert Fox, this gifted German commander, scoring victories on all fronts in North Africa. And so the idea behind the formation of the SAS is really to try to help turn the tide of the battle. If you get these small groups of men deep behind the lines and particular to hit enemy air bases, take out their warplanes on the ground before they could get into the air and bomb and strafe British forces, then that would potentially be a game changer. And that's why the idea of forming the SAS actually, you know, got the green light, because there was an awful lot of resistance, deeply unpopular at this idea that you would have these more or less freelance piratical raiders wreaking havoc far behind the lines with very little control or orders constraining them. That was a deeply unpopular idea with most in high command, and it was really born of desperation, the desperation of staring defeat in the face, that said, okay, let's unleash these raiders and see what they can do, you know, on Rommel's air bases.
I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I presume the top brass were like, well, this is the most ungentlemanly way to fight war. You know, let's not forget, you know, the horrors of the First World War had scarred, if you like, the you know, generations. But you know, there was some previous in this with in terms of desert fighting. I mean, we think about, you know, Lawrence of Arabia and his use of, if you like, I mean, he was using local troops, but they were fast moving skirmishing hit and run attacks rather than the more conventional warfare that the British were being beaten at in North Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. So you could argue Lawrence of Arabia and his forces were kind of the forerunners to this type of soldiering, you know, the modern day special forces. This is the birth of it. But, you know, it's that desperation which turned that tide of opprobrium and resistance. You're absolutely right. You know, most of those offers, especially in Middle East Command, which was, you know, North Africa, were World War One veterans. And so they had, you know, they had experienced the horror of trench warfare. And they had these ideas of, you know, gentlemanly conduct and how a British officer should purport themselves at war. But as Churchill had rightly, you know, identified, you know, this was total war. You know, Hitler was not going to fight by the rules of gentlemanly conduct. He wasn't even going to abide, as we learned, by the Geneva Convention, quite the reverse. So, you know, Churchill had rightly called for butcher and bolt rage, you know, leave a trail of German corpses across, you know, enemy lands. Let no enemy soldier sleep soundly in their bed at night. These were his words. And, you know, he was a massive, massive supporter of, and in fact, the founder of special forces soldiering, when he called for his special service volunteers, you know, the formation of the commandos right after defeat on France and Dunkirk in June 1940. This is when Churchill first put out his call for these kind of operations. And so, you know, massive resistance from local command in North Africa, massive support from, you know, Britain's wartime leader, and this massive need, you know, defeat, you know, wrecking our chances in North Africa led to the formation of the SAS.
So what sort of, how do you put out that call? I mean, what sort of individuals? I mean, they are described, and, you know, we're going down the realms of Hollywood here, you know, a bunch of rogues and misfits, etc. It makes them sound like, you know, they'd gone into the nearest sort of the cantina at Mos Eisley and dragged the half of them out and gone, right, you can go off and start harassing Rommel's troops. So what sort of men, what sort of people were attracted to this sort of soldiering? It hadn't been done before, so they were sort of making it up as they went along, if you like. And it wasn't a case where, because fighting in the desert, there are quite a few obstacles, including water, the terrain, your fuel supplies, logistics, and you know, working out where on earth you are.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it was such a brilliant idea. Of course, you know, General Rommel and his German and Italian, you know, commanders simply could not conceive of the fact that it was possible to penetrate, survive in, navigate, and fight from the Sahara Desert. It was just inconceivable to them. Give you an example. So the first ever raid that was successful by the SAS, the Italian commander actually on the airbase, we're now talking November 1941, and the airbase was absolutely torn to pieces. You know, the officers' mess was shot up. The ammo and fuel dumps were laced with bombs and blown to smithereens. And then most of the aircraft were also blown to pieces. And the Italian commander believed it was an Allied landing from the coast. So amphibious forces believed there was an invasion and demanded reinforcements and to evacuate his aerodrome. And that lack of belief that these raiders could be striking from the desert, that lasted for quite a long time, just this refusal to believe that anyone could be doing this. So what kind of guys were attracted to this? Well, you know, they were all volunteers. That's the first point to make. And they were from all walks of life. I think the key thing that that defined them was imagination and thinking completely outside of the box. You know, if you're going to launch raids and attacks by a means which the enemy least suspects, you've got to be able to think of the unthinkable. And that meant these were highly intelligent, very imaginative, self-starting, independent, but crucially laterally thinking individuals. They could think of ways to hit at the enemy which the enemy didn't believe possible. And so, you know, they were harnessable, as David Stirling, the commander, the founder of the SAS, put it, not commandable. You know, he had this brilliant way of bringing out the best in his troops, in his volunteers, and that he made them feel as if they were special and on a special mission and involved in the most important missions that were ever going to take place in the war. So rarely did he order a man to do anything. He just asked them very politely and made them feel utterly brilliant. And he also had this way to bring out the absolute best of, you know, this band of recruits, these people who stepped forward to volunteer, who weren't always the easiest to control. So I'll give you another example. You know, his deputy, if you like, was then Lieutenant Blair Paddy Mayne. And, you know, this was an individual who, you know, was even before the war, the Irish University's boxing, heavyweight boxing champion, and an astounding rugby player, capped multiple times for the Irish team, and also had played in the British Lions in 1938. And so Stirling brilliantly appointed Mayne at their earliest training base, both the PT physical training officer, which was a great idea, but also the discipline officer. And Mayne instituted his own very particular kind of discipline, which was basically that if you were involved in infraction, you would come before Mayne, you would admit what you had done, and then Mayne would say, okay, you've now got to stand as many rounds as you can in the boxing ring with me, and then it will all be forgotten. There'll be no paperwork. You know, bygones will be bygones. And that was a great way of, one, keeping discipline, but it also absolutely, enshrined the kind of spirit and the esprit de corps of the regiment, that this was a unit where merit mattered, not rank, where, you know, individuals were respected for what they would bring to the party, and everyone had their say, and, you know, everyone's opinion was respected.
And this in an organisation that hitherto had been hidebound with convention, with rank, etc., was quite something. But it had to be that because of the hostile conditions in which they were fighting. And this was at a point where they rocked up and they were wearing their best shiny medals or their... It wasn't it. I mean, they were if you saw them... If they were on foot, because obviously the transport given away, but you would just think they were a bunch of Berber or Bedouin who were just wandering around. They didn't, you know, they, unlike other units who, or unlike the German units, of course, that, you know, they who stood out, these guys blended in. They were masters of camouflage, or at least, you know, you would look at them and think, okay, that's just a bunch of goat herders.
Yeah, I mean, you know, dress was personal choice. So, you know, you could wear whatever you felt most comfortable in. So, you know, by hook or by crook, they ended up in a hodgepodge of uniforms, allied equipment, enemy equipment. They loved the Italian backpacks because they were far better than British. They loved the Bedouin goat skin, coats because they were warm and it was bitterly cold in the desert at night, especially during the winter. So yeah, they were, you know, and also bear in mind, you know, what weapon you carried was also your personal choice, as long as there was a proper mixture of firepower across each of the patrols, you could carry whatever weapon you saw fit. So yeah, I mean, there are so many stories of, you know, raids taking place where they get, for example, shot up by an enemy aircraft the next day and they have to escape and evade on foot. Some of these incredible epic escape and evasion stories. And often they did wander through Italian or German camps. And because they were dressed in a way which an Italian or German soldier could conceivably be dressed, they pretty much got away with it very often. And so that was one of their, you know, key planks of their operations, that, you know, they were to be indistinguishable from the enemy as much as possible.
I mean, there are some, you know, throughout the stories that you've written in your excellent books, there are stories of, as we call in Spain, you know, massive cojones going on here, you know, wandering through camps, you know, when they're blowing up airfields. And you just think there's no way a small group of people would do that. But it says something about, as you mentioned before, that esprit de corps and the fact that each man was self-sufficient and had absolute confidence in his quote-unquote brother-in-arms.
Yeah, you speak to veterans, you know, from the time, as I have done, obviously, and I actually had, you know, two surviving veterans of the SAS. There are not very many left, but two from World War II, you know, not only contribute to the manuscript and, you know, taught me through some of these, you know, characters and operations, but one of them, Jack Mann, actually read the manuscript from cover to cover in draft form to give me his feedback. Absolutely fantastic. You know, that's indispensable. But you talk to World War II veterans, or indeed modern day veterans of the SAS, and what do they say is the thing that keeps you going in the battle or on an operation or on an epic escape and evasion when you know all around you might be, you know, falling apart? And it's the need to stand tall and to stand firm with those guys on your shoulder. That's the key thing. So that esprit de corps is absolutely vital. And one other thing I would say is that, you know, you had leaders in people like Paddy Mayne, David Stirling, Bill Fraser, the Scotsman, another standout founder of the SAS, Jock Lewis until he was killed, and others who they had a specific style of leadership, and it's absolutely crucial to understand this. This was not leadership by orders or rank or status. It was leadership by inspiration, by leading from the front, by not expecting their soldiers to do anything they wouldn't do themselves. And indeed, letting those troops under their command know that they cared for them deeply and would always bring them home if they could. So you read the accounts of those who served under somebody like Paddy Mayne, for example, because he, of course, became the commander of the SAS once David Stirling was captured in early 1943. And the one overriding sentiment that comes through is they understood and appreciated Mayne's care for them as soldiers under his command, and they believed so much that he would bring them home. That's what made them willing to step into hell with him time and time again.
I mean, Churchill talked about no German soldier or Italian soldier was being able to sleep soundly in their bed. Was there this, did they have the psychological impact as well as the, obviously, the destructive impact that they'd been aiming for?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let's not forget, you know, during their time in North Africa, so we're talking from summer 41 through to spring 43, the SAS destroyed 387 warplanes. That's confirmed, and very likely far more, because they always underreported however many they destroyed, because they knew they had so many enemies in high command who would give them grief if they were found to have over-egged the pudding. So they did. So just in terms of their actual physical impact on the ground, in terms of turning the battle, this was extraordinary. But, you know, General Rommel eventually realized who these guys were and that they were coming out of the desert impossibly. And he nicknamed them Stirling's Commandos. And he said towards the end of the war, this unit, and I paraphrase, caused me more damage than any other unit of a similar size. But more importantly, he identified the damage and the impact it had on the morale of his troops. Because if you think about it, if you're hundreds of kilometers behind your own front line, feeling absolutely safe and secure in the rear area at an airbase or on a supply convoy, and suddenly from out of the desert arrive these piratical looking raiders in their jeeps, heavily armed jeeps mounted with machine guns, and they tear your airbase or your convoy to pieces, that is absolutely soul destroying in terms of your morale, because it makes you think, where can I be safe? And not only that, it makes you think, what it does, you know, regardless of rank, any one of us can be here at any moment. So, yes, indeed, you end up not being able to sleep soundly in your bed at night, as Churchill had averred.
And, of course, for those who think that the desert is just this big, flat, sandy thing, you know, if you've been to the Sahara, it's not. You can hide. You can go undercover. So people said, well, what, you know, why didn't the Luftwaffe just blow them off the sand? It's not like that. You really can camouflage yourself. And with those jeeps, which were also integral too, because they were relatively easy to maintain, and the desert is an absolute, it's very difficult to get parts, etc. You know, those jeeps mounted with those high caliber machine guns were devastating in their impact.
Yeah, sure. No, the invention of the Willis Jeep, so this American four-wheel drive vehicle, first four-wheel drive vehicle, and absolutely brilliant across desert terrain. But you couple that with the SAS getting these Vickers K machine guns, which they scavenge from old RAF aircraft, bolt them onto the Jeeps. Suddenly they've got a war wagon with which they can drive into the desert and take the war to the enemy. And they did that because Rommel had eventually realized they were coming in on foot and had massively strengthened his defenses at his air bases. So, but with the Willis Jeep, with a convoy of 20 of those, you can just blast your way through defences, drive down the runway, blast apart all the enemy warplanes and disappear just as quickly. Absolutely brilliant and inspired. And, you know, bear in mind, you know, they actually managed to then base themselves not in Egypt, but right in the middle of the Sahara. So at Bir el Kizir, for example, this kind of chasm that cut through the desert, camouflage the jeeps with camouflage netting, throw some vegetation over them, and they base themselves there for weeks on end. So going out in these jeeps, repeatedly hitting enemy positions. And, you know, very little Rommel could do about it, apart from, of course, sending his warplanes after them. But if you can't see them, you can't destroy them.
There was, obviously, we had to talk about the successes in North Africa, but you could argue that when the campaign moves to Italy, this is a role that perhaps the SAS, those particular troops, weren't perhaps accustomed to fine, because I know they took heavy casualties in Italy, including now correct, but wasn't Jock killed in Italy as well, because there was an ambush or a bombing or during one of the raids, and that was if you like the denouement of that particular group.
Yeah, so I mean, as I say, Stirling captured in February 43. You know, North Africa campaign pretty much won. You know, about to launch the landings in Italy, the soft underbelly of Europe, as Churchill called it, which it didn't turn out to be at all, of course. And you know, there were many in high command argued the SAS was done. It had been formed for desert raiding operations. The desert war was over. So what did we have need of them? And Paddy Main and others, Bill Stirling and others, argued vehemently the SAS still had a role and it could spearhead those landings in southern Italy. As you say, not what the SAS had been trained for at all. Those are frontline operations. The SAS had been formed to go deep behind the lines, but they kept the unit alive, and that was the key thing. They kept the unit alive by arguing it still had relevance. And during the Italian campaign, once those frontline kind of initial operations had been carried out with heavy losses, as you say, they then reverted much more to their former role, parachuting deep behind enemy lines and carrying out the kind of operations that, you know, are classic SAS missions. And again, proved their worth, that you could still carry out this kind of irregular special forces raiding operations deep behind the lines, even in a country like Italy.
And if you think about, you know, the recent conflicts that have been available, both Gulf Wars, Afghanistan, this is the sort of, you know, that sort of terrain is embedded into the SAS's DNA.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I wrote Bravo, SAS Bravo 3-0, the other Bravo patrol last year with Des Powell. Mm. So Des Powell's a modern day SAS veteran, and that's about the 1991 Gulf War. Fascinating. When they sat on the start lines in Saudi Arabia, about to drive across the Saudi Arabia border and fly across into the desert, they said to each other, this is exactly what David Stirling and the SAS did in North Africa. The only difference is we've got slightly better vehicles in Land Rovers and slightly better weaponry. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. We're going to drive into the desert, spend weeks on end dodging the enemy, trying to hunt down Scud missiles. You know, they were hunting down enemy air bases. What's changed? Absolutely. That's a very fair point to make.
The book is cool. What do you hope that people take from SAS, from your book? What do you, to get a little bit behind that sort of... Because, I mean, they say that the truth is stranger than fiction, but they really were swashbuckling, weren't they? They really did set a standard of that whole, the reason some things become cliches is the fact that there is more than a nugget of truth in it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think what people are taking from the book is that, you know, here's the founding of the SAS in a kind of classic of combat writing, which is, it's never been told in this kind of detail before. And also, I think it brings home, and this is crucial, you know, I had the manuscript read by a post-traumatic stress disorder expert, Ros Townsend, and she said one of these missions behind the lines would be enough to give you that kind of trauma. 5 years of back-to-back operations like this, you know, the cost on these guys is absolutely incredible. So that's also kind of brought to the fore towards the end. The drip-drip cumulative effect of these kind of operations and what that does to you, and what that does to your, you know, to your psyche and your ability to keep operating. So it's a really gritty, warts and all, you know, on the ground account of the founding of the SAS. And, you know, I think people are actually, you know, very, very kind of, it takes you into that world like they've never been taken into it before.
The book is called SAS Brothers in Arms. It's by Damien Lewis, who we're speaking to today. Damien, if people want to find you online and follow you and on the social media and download some of your excellent books, where can they find you?
Yeah, so my website is just my name, DamienLewis.com. I'm on Twitter at Author D. Lewis and Facebook Writer Damien Lewis. And yeah, please do go to those sites and have a look at the new book. It's a great read.
Absolutely, as they all are. And especially the stuff that you bring out is, like I said, absolutely mind-blowing. The stuff that went on that we're only now beginning. I suppose the other thing is the fact that when the member of the group read the book and read that manuscript and said, yep, that was how it was, that's got to be the greatest compliment as a writer of these, because of the respect that you show to the protagonists.
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. There's nothing better. We had a launch at the National Army Museum in London of the book two or three weeks ago, and that veteran, Jack Mann, was there. So we had a World War II veteran, and I was being interviewed by Des Powell. So we had, you know, the legacy all the way through to the modern day. It was a magical evening. We had a we had the only living Victoria Cross recipient, Johnson Bihari, was there. You know, magical evening, and that you know, showcasing that legacy is a wonderful thing to be doing.
The book is called SAS Brothers in Arms. Damien Lewis, thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate it, and let's get another interview when we can, yeah?